So we are live, and again, I want to welcome everyone to another wonderful opportunity that we have to learn together. It is so nice to see your names, if not your faces, and I definitely look forward to the day when we can once again be studying together in person. And as much as I enjoy this, as I say each and every week, it is not the same as the chevra of the opportunity to learn together. So again, I want to welcome everyone, and again, daven for the day when you and I can be together learning and interacting with each other. Today we have a real treat. We're going to study chapter 8 of Tehillim, Perek Ches of Tehillim. And as you'll see, there are going to be a lot of parts of it that are going to be very familiar to you, whether it's from various Gemaras that you're familiar with, or certain lines, which are going to be quite popular. And you're going to hear them and you're going to say, "Oh, I know those from somewhere," and I will connect the dots. But we have some really beautiful, beautiful Torah this morning. Again, anyone who wants to sponsor this year, sponsorships are available. Memory of a loved one, celebrate a simcha, whatever the case might be, you are welcome to contact me afterwards, and we can certainly arrange that. The weekly is going to print today, so if you'd like it in for next week, do not miss out. Okay, chapter 8 of Tehillim. I'm going to share my screen with you so that those at least who are watching on Zoom are going to be able to see it, and the rest of you, you should watch on Zoom. So here we go. Chapter 8 of Tehillim. And here we go. Lamnatzeach ala gitis, mizmor leDavid. Lamnatzeach ala gitis. We don't know what gitis means. So if you look in Rashi, Rashi tells us that gitit is klizemer. It is a type of musical instrument. And then he says, V'rabosenu amru al Edom, she'asida lidarech kegas. What is a gitit? What is a gas? Anyone who learns Gemara is going to be familiar with that term. A gas is an olive press. Lamnatzeach ala gitis, says Rashi, is referring to our prayer of a time when God will literally crush our enemies. Imagining that olive press or that wine press where it presses down on the grapes and it squashes it into oblivion, that is what, ultimately, according to Rashi, what we are davening to here. I would be remiss I did not mention my favorite episode ever of I Love Lucy. And by the way, when I say my favorite episode ever, I mean the only episode I think I ever saw in my life. But there's a great episode where she's in the olive press and she's stomping with her feet. I see some of the more seasoned members of our shiur right now know exactly what I'm talking about. So that's exactly the imagery, says Rashi, that we are describing here, is literally trouncing our enemies. But I don't really like that, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I love Rashi, because it has a very negative connotation. We don't like leaving us with negative connotations. So instead, I want to share with you Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch says that the gitis, the gat, the olive press, the crushing of the grapes, is not referring to the nations of the world. It's not referring to our enemies. Rather, says Rav Hirsch, it refers to us. Now here's the beautiful idea. It refers to us. God's going to crush us like grapes and like olives. How does that sound so exciting? Says Rav Hirsch, you're missing the whole point. Anyone who's ever made wine or watched wine made knows something very simple, right? I used to be a rabbinic intern in Oakland, California. So in Oakland, California, which is right underneath wine country, right underneath Napa Valley. So wine is obviously very important there. So for their shul dinner every year, what they did was someone donated a row of grapes in a vineyard, and for the shul dinner, they auctioned off that row of grapes. And what essentially is, it was a package deal. You didn't just get the grapes, but you got a wine-making experience. And you literally got to go with your family, pick the grapes, then you harvested, right? You did everything, right? Then you squashed the grapes, then you fermented the grapes, then you eventually got a bottle of wine out of it, but it was an exercise for your entire family, and it stretched out the entire year. And really, by the way, made the Shlosh Regalim come to life. Because when you talk about the harvest season, right, that's real when you're outside in the vineyard. So I remember when I was there one time was when it was time to press the grapes, right? And it's a very, very interesting experience. So you press the grapes, and you and I both know that when you press the grapes, you are not destroying the grapes. What are you creating? You're creating a far better product. Says Rav Hirsch, that's what it means. Lamnatzeach ala gitis. It's not the destruction of our enemies like Rashi suggests, but rather it is referring to us. I'm going to read to you what Rav Hirsch says. He says it refers to an olive press. This figure of speech, however, indicates that what is meant is only apparent destruction. While in reality, the painful bruising pressure, such as occurs during the wine pressing operation, does not destroy, but only brings out the fine and noble essence that was locked within the crushed grape. Right? A grape is a grape. How much do you buy grapes for in Publix and Winn-Dixie? $10 maybe, right, for an entire thing of grapes? That same thing of grapes put in a bottle of wine becomes a lot more expensive. Why? Because once you crush the grapes, something so much more beautiful and fragrant and delicious comes out as a result of it. Therefore, says Rav Hirsch, what we are meditating upon is the nobling effect of those afflictions decreed by God for the moral betterment of mankind. Something that we spoke about last week as well. That we firmly believe that when Hashem puts affliction on us, that one of the reasons we learned the Netziv last week is so that we can emerge as a better, stronger product. That, says Rav Hirsch, is what we were talking about here. L'menatzeach al hagitis mizmor l'David. That it's referring to the Jewish people. Now, that pasuk 1 is somewhat of a parenthetical pasuk. Let me summarize the chapter for you, and then we are going to go pasuk by pasuk. The summary of the chapter is very simple. We are going to be reflecting upon the greatness of Hashem's creation, and we are going to be reflecting upon our place within the world around us. So we're going to be reflecting upon how amazing, awesome, big the world is, and also, therefore, what our place, us as human beings, what place we play in that world. Now, we know that man, and this is exactly what this Parakatilim is talking about, we know that there's an inherent contradiction when it comes to mankind. That on the other hand, on the one hand, we are nothing, right? We're here one second, we're gone the next. We make a lot of mistakes, unlike the sun and the moon and the stars, which do their job to Hashem dutifully and like clockwork, right? I could predict exactly when the sun is going to do its job tomorrow morning. Mankind is much more fickle, right? Sometimes we do what Hashem asks of us. Sometimes we don't do what Hashem asks of us. So on the one hand, we're nothing. And we'll see the pasuk in a second. Ma enosh kisis karena. What is mankind that God should even care about us? On the other hand, you and I both know that you and I have infinite potential for greatness. That we were created, B'Tselem Elohim, we were created in the image of God. And so there's an inherent contradiction within mankind. That contradiction is exactly what our Parak of Tehillim is talking about. Right? We look around the world and we see how amazing the world is. We reflect upon the greatness of Hashem. And then at the same time, we say, well, what does that make us? On the one hand, it makes us absolutely nothing. We're the dust of the earth. That's where we came. That's where we're returning. On the other hand, God gave us a neshama. God gave us a chelak eloka mimal. He gave us a part of him. He created us b'tzelem elokim. And I think that's why this chapter of Tehillim is so relevant nowadays. And again, I'm kind of doing the broad theme, and then we'll go through the individual psukim. I usually do the opposite. But because I think this is so relevant to the time period that you and I are experiencing now, on the one hand, you have this feeling of mankind's incredible capacity to conquer the world around us. Think about the scientific, technological advances of just the last 20 years alone, and you will be utterly astounded by what mankind has been able to create. Right? Over the last 50 years plus, we've been able to take man out of this world, go to the moon, see other universes. Through technology, what we've been able to do for health, longevity for mankind, what we've been able to do to heal illness and prevent sickness, right? Mankind has come so far, and it's really astounding. And on the other hand, if one thing the last 3 months have shown us is that no matter how far we have come, you and I are more vulnerable than ever, right? Within literally overnight. When I think that just a few months ago, I was sitting with 18,000 people in a conference center in Washington. It's mind-boggling to even think that way, right? When I think that in February I was on a plane with Rabbi Goldberg to Israel for Rabbi Brody's daughter's wedding, again, it's almost incomprehensible to think that way, that in just a short period of time, the entire world was crumbled to its knees, was humbled in such a profound way. And that's really the dichotomy. It's that tension over the last 3 months, which I think is exactly our Parak of Tehillim. On the one hand, we are incredible. What we have been able to create, technology, healthcare, going to the moon, right? Again, SpaceX, think about what was accomplished just last week, where the first ever privatized industry was able to send something into space. It's extraordinary. It's something that we couldn't have dreamed of 60, 70 years ago. On the other hand, we also couldn't have dreamed that a little thing that started in some province in China would all of a sudden literally bring the entire world economy to its heels. That dichotomy, that contradiction in what mankind stands for is exactly this parak. So now let's go pasuk by pasuk, and you'll see, again, some psukim that are very familiar, and you'll see a theme, which again I think is very relatable to all of us. Pasuk 2, Adonai Adonenu, Ma Adir Shimcha B'chol Aretz, again, Hashem, how great your name is throughout the entire world, Asher Tna Hodcha Al HaShamayim, right? You have put your splendor, you put your greatness all over the world. Rashi says that what is this talking about? Ma Adir Shimcha, how great your name is, says Rashi, Yosir Michtei Koach Midas HaTachtonim, Lo Hayu HaTachtonim Kedai Shetishra Shchinascha Benem. You know what the words, Ma Adir Shimcha, how great your name is, Hashem? Says Rashi, what we're essentially communicating is we're not worthy of your hashkacha. We are not worthy, Hashem, of your divine providence. Asher tenahotcha al hashamayim. Says Rashi, ve'ata be'avanosecha hagedola, right? Be'anvusecha hagedola, yisadata oz. Right? It's only through your humility, Hashem, that you, so to speak, were mitzamtzem yourself. You restricted yourself to enable mankind to exist in this world. So Pasuk 2, which should be familiar to you, A, because we say it on Hoshana Rabbah, in between the Hoshanos, right, in between the Hakafos, and because it sounds very familiar to the phrase that we say on Musaf of the Shlosh Regalim, Adonai Adonenu Ma'adir Shimcha, right, V'haya Hashem El Melech HaKol Arts Bayo, Ma'ahu, Yeh Hashem, right? So the phraseology is familiar to us, but if you read Rashi's interpretation of it, it's a statement of humility. It's a statement of gratitude, right? Hashem doesn't need us. Hashem created the space for us to be able to exist. And it's appreciation that Hashem, so to speak, was mitzamtzem himself to allow us to exist. The Malbim points out, and it's a very lengthy Malbim, we're not going to read it inside, but the Malbim points out that part of the majesty, part of the greatness of Hashem is that it does not exclude man, but rather includes us, right? One of the great things about HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not the fact that mankind exists, that lessens Hashem, but that despite the fact that Hashem didn't need us, He nonetheless created a world for us to enjoy, for us to benefit from, and for us to be able to partner together with Him in its continued creation. Pasuk Gimel is utterly magnificent. Mipi olalim v'yonkim, Yasarita oz leman tzorecha lahashpit oyev umitnakim. Right? Mipi olalim v'yonkim, the sucklings, the infants, the little children that you founded your strength leman tzorecha for your enemies lahashpit oyev umitnakim. Right? Again, to push away, to put an end to those enemies. Rashi says, what are we talking about? The mouths of children. Says Rashi, yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. Mipi olalim v'yonkim, hasharit shchinascha b'mikdash. Right? Who are the ones that worked in the Beis HaMikdash? All of your great ones, we say to Hashem, the Kohanim, the Levim, the Talmidei Chachamim, what did they start out as? They too started out as children who used to, pardon the expression, poop in their diapers. They used to soil their diapers. In other words, what we're essentially saying to Hashem, says Rashi, is mankind that starts from such a lowly place, you have empowered us to play the most critical roles in the world around us. Even the Kohanim, even the Levim, even those who play those central roles in your Beis HaMikdash, Hashem, they started from such a lowly level. They started from such a puny level. Radak says a little bit differently. Any parent or grandparent will certainly appreciate Radak's interpretation. He says, "Mitchilas tzeis ha'olel la'avir ba'olam." From the moment a child comes into this world, uvemini kaso, and from when he starts suckling, in other words, from the moment a child is born, Nikarim niflaos habore vechazdo ala adam. We immediately become aware of and appreciative of the miracles of Hashem in this world, right? Mipi olalim v'yonkim yisadat oz. It's through your children, Hashem, that we see your strength. It's seeing the way that a child is born. It's seeing the whole way that a child comes into this world from the moment of conception, every little thing that needs to go right in order for a healthy baby to be born. If you think about it, your mind is going to go crazy because it's simply incomprehensible. Says David HaMelech, Mipi olim v'yomkim. If we reflect even for a minute on a baby who does nothing but eat and sleep and go to the bathroom, right? Even a child, if we look at that, you'll see the incredible miracles of Hashem. As we grow older, of course, we become much more aware of it. The way that our bodies work, the fact that our bodies work in a healthy fashion, the fact that we are able to eat and digest and relieve ourselves in a healthy fashion. Every time we reflect upon that, says Radak, we become aware of Nikarim niflaos habore v'chazdo al adam. We become intimately aware of the greatness, the chesed of Hashem that He displays on mankind. I'm going to save Rav Hirsch's because Rav Hirsch nails it on this pasuk, but I'm going to save it to the end. So that's a little bit of a teaser. But the last thing I'll share with you, and many of the Mefarshim point out as well, is that the reference to children here is not simply that a child, even from the moment that it's born, we become aware of the miracles of Hashem. It's not just Rashi who says that even a child, someone who was soiling their diapers, they can grow to the highest of heights. That's what we're aware of. But if you think about the role that children play in Judaism, that displays the greatness of Hashem. Think about every single enemy that has come to destroy the Jewish people. What have they started with? They start with the children. They start with our schools. They start with our, right, with trying to cut off our Talmud Torah, because they were always recognized that if you can cut off the children, if you can destroy the children, then you destroy the Jewish people. What did Paro go after? The very first thing Paro tries to destroy is the children, right? Haman, if you think about the Gemaras in Maseches Megillah, Haman, what does he try to do? What ultimately deters Haman is when he sees the children learning Torah, Haman says, you're right, I'm never going to be able to destroy the Jewish people. We know that Hitler, right? The very first thing, you try to close the schools, you try to close the Talmud Torah, the Russians, right? The Russians tried to cut off our access to information and knowledge. They figured that if they can prevent a generation from Jews from learning Torah, then they'll wipe the Jews off the face of the earth. And unfortunately, they were somewhat successful in that. Thank God, not entirely successful. But it's the children. It's our ability to educate children. It's our ability to inspire children in Talmud Torah, which guarantees the perseverance and the perpetuation of the Jewish people. So whether it was Haman, or whether it was Hitler, or whether it was the Russians. Think about the book of Daniel. Again, I can go on and on. Think about the book of Daniel. When Nebuchadnezzar captures Yerushalayim, what does he do to Daniel? He takes so many of the young men of Yerushalayim, and what does he do? Just look at the first parak of Daniel after this class, and you'll see. He tries to assimilate them, changes their names, changes their speech, tries to get them to eat non-kosher, right? None of which are particularly significant in their own right, but when you package them together, what was Nebuchadnezzar trying to do? Exactly what Haman was trying to do, and exactly what the Russians were trying to do. They were trying to wipe out the Jewish people by cutting off the children. If you cut off the children, you siphon off an entire generation. And so, Mipi olalim v'yonkim yisadata oz, says David HaMelech, right, from the infants, from the children, is where you find your strength. It's why for thousands of years, the Jewish people have invested in education. Rabbi Sachs has some beautiful quotes about that. Right, for thousands of years, long before education was popular, the Jewish people recognized that the sustainability of our model rests upon the education of our children. That, say many of the Mefarshim, is exactly what we're talking about here. Mipi olalim v'yonkim. It's through the mouths of the infants and the children. Yisadat ha'oz. That is what we found. That is what we build upon, Hashem. Leman Sarecha Lahashpis Oyeva Misnakim. You want to know the best way to put an end to our enemies, to take vengeance against those who tried to destroy us? It's by educating the next generation of children. It's about inspiring a new generation to take on the mantle of leadership, of Torah leadership. Right? We had on behind the bima last night, Rav Aaron Cutler. If you haven't yet seen it, it was really an inspiring conversation. But he makes this exact argument. He says, in addition to raising our children to be great scholars and scientists, and right, and all that's amazing and wonderful, right? We have to raise the next generation of Yir Shamayim and Lomdei Torah, people who are going to carry that mantle of Torah leadership into the next generation. That is a fulfillment of this pasuk. Mipi Olalim V'Yonkim, right? It's through the mouths of the children that Lahashpit Oyev Umit Nakim, that we are going to take revenge against our enemies. That every time a Jewish child steps into a school or steps onto a Zoom, right? That is our revenge against thousands of years of people who tried to cut us off from our lifeline. As I got in trouble a number of months ago, right? When you cut a flower off from the ground, you are simply counting down the clock until it withers away and dies. The Jewish people are no different. So long as we are connected to our lifeline, so much as we are connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to Hashem, to His Torah, so we're alive and we're vibrant and we're dynamic and we're going to continue to grow. The moment you cut that off, that simply is a dangerous, dangerous decline of the Jewish people. Okay, beautiful pasuk. Now, don't let me forget Rav Hirsch. Okay, who am I looking at here? Chaim, do not let me forget Rav Hirsch. If I try to end the shir without Rav Hirsch, I want you to wave like this and say, no, Rabbi Moskowitz, you cannot end the shir without Rav Hirsch, because it's going to be a beautiful pshat that is going to blow your mind away. Pasuk 4. Ki er'eh shamecha ma'aseh etzbosecha. Right? Ki er'eh shamecha. Hashem, when I look at your shamayim, when I look at your heavens, ma'aseh etzbosecha, when I look at the handiwork of your fingers, yareach v'kochavim asher konanta, all the heavens and the earth and the sun and the moon and the stars, all of the things that you put in place, what is my reaction? Ma'enosh ki siskarenu, uven adam ki tifkedenu. How do I respond when I look at the heavens and the earth and the universe? What is my response? Ma'enosh ki siskarenu. I realize just how insignificant I am. We become in awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? And then we recognize that dichotomy, the contradiction of mankind. And that's exactly, it's a pasuk about humility. Those who say Yisker know that this is the first pasuk that we say when we introduce Yisker. I could hear Mr. Judovitz in my ear right now, right? Ma'anash tizkarenu venadam kitiv, right? We say these exact words because it's a statement, it's a reflection upon man's humility. Again, as I said in the earlier, coronavirus reminds us that while we think we conquered the world, we conquered the heavens and the earth through science and technology and development, right, that the world can be turned around overnight. If there's one pasuk that symbolizes to me the last 3 months, it's this, Ma'enosh ki tizkarenu, uven adam ki tifkedenu, right? What is mankind, right? What are we truly made of and capable of, right? How quickly we can be destroyed and taken away and removed from this world. So ultimately, Psukim 4 and 5, when put together, is a profound statement of humility. Ma'anosh ki siskrenu. It's a very down pasuk also, right? And again, when I talk about writing Tehillim, right, we always talk about what's the tone? What emotions does it conjure up when you read a pasuk? So when you read Psukim 4 and 5, so you're in awe and reverence of Hashem, and you're put down a little bit about what we, mankind, represent. And then Pasuk 6 takes us in the exact opposite direction. Vatichserehu me'at me'elokim. At that exact same moment that we say, what are we? We're puny, we're nothing, Hashem. But then we say, Vatichserehu me'at me'elohim. You made us just a little bit less than the divine. Right? What a profound statement. That you made us just a little bit less than the divine. On the one hand, we're nothing. Ma'anosh, what are we? On the other hand, you know what we are? We're so close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'chavod v'hadar te'atreyu. God adorned us with His glory and with His kavod. Says the Radak, what are we talking about here? we are talking about b'neshama ha'elyona shenatata bo. Hashem, you gave us a neshama. Right? Elokai neshama shenasata bi. The neshama that you gave us, tehorahi, it's beautiful. Atat, right? So, you can't have more of a discrepancy in Psukim than Psukim 4 and 5 on the one hand, and Pasuk 6 on the other hand. Right? On the other, one hand, ma'ado anosh kitis karenu. What are we? We're nothing. We're from the earth. We're going to return to the earth. And on the other hand, batechasreyu me'at me'elohim, we're just a little bit less Hashem, you gave us that chelek eloka mimal. The Medrash writes this explicitly. One of those beautiful Midrashim. Actually, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz in the Sichos Musar has a beautiful pshat of this, where the Pasuk says, right, kedoshim tihiyu, that we shall be holy. The Medrash says, it might be a Gemara, I don't remember off the top of my head, I apologize, right? Yachal kamoni, Hashem says, lest you think that you are going to be like me, tam lomar ki kadosh ani. No, that Hashem is always going to be above us. Ask Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, whoa, wait a second. Let's unpack the hava amina, which means the implication of Hashem's question. Yachol kamoni, Hashem asks, do you think that mankind can be like me? No, I'm going to be greater than mankind. Says Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, the hava amina, in other words, the assumption of Hashem's question, is staggering. That Hashem could even entertain the possibility that we could ever be yachol kamoni, that we could ever be similar to Hashem. Yeah, that's pasuk vav here. Vatechasrehu me'at me'elohim. Hashem made us just a little bit less than us. He gave us that chelak eloka mimal. He gave us that neshama. And so within three psukim, we traverse the gamut of what mankind represents. On the one hand, we reflect upon our utter pathetic nature, our humility, just how puny we are. And on the other hand, we talk about how great we are. Vatechasrehu me'at me'elokim. We're just a little bit less. By the way, I'll take that. I'll take being just a little bit less than Hashem any day of the week. Right? You put me at the foot of Hashem, and I'll take it. And by the way, v'chavod v'hadar te'atreyu, Hashem adorns us with His glory and His majesty. I'll take that as well. Tamshilehu b'maase yadecha. Oops, sorry. Tamshilehu b'maase yadecha kol shata tachas raglav. Right? What did Hashem make us? He made us the master over His handiwork. Right? The world is our oyster. The world is laying at our feet. In other words, you looked at the sun and the moon and the stars and you saw how beautiful it is. You looked at Hashem's world and you saw how amazing it is and majestic it is. Well, Pasuk Zion comes along and says, all of that, all of Hashem's creation is for one purpose and one purpose only. And that is for us to rule over it. It is for us to benefit from. It is for us to enjoy from. Right? Hashem, you made the world so great, but you only made it great so that mankind can become even greater, so that we can rule over it, so that we can benefit from it. Tzona elaf ve'alafim kulam v'gam behemo shaddai, right, sheep and oxen and wild beasts, right, just we're detailing all of the creation. Tzipor shamayim u'dgei hayam, whether it's the birds in the heavens and the fish in the sea, in other words, basically saying from Dan ad Beersheva, right? East, west, north, south, anything God created. Over Archos Yamim, anything you want to look at. What do you see? Adonai Adonenu Ma'adir Shimcha Bechol Aretz. How great you are, Hashem. Says Radak, what are we talking about? That final pasuk, Adonai Adonenu Ma'adir Shimcha Bechol Aretz, how great you are in this world. Says the Radak, this is a summation of everything we've been talking about. Says the Radak Kashir, Kilala Saper, when we conclude to tell over HaChesed She'asa La'adam, the Chesed, the kindness that Hashem does to mankind, right? V'hayecholet She'natan lo, and the capacity, the capability that He gave us, V'hu Katan Keneged HaBrios Shamala, Shav Lehodos V'amar Adonai Adonenu. we return to thank Hashem. And so, as I started off with, this parak of Tehillim truly runs the gamut of human emotions. On the one hand, we reflect upon the greatness of Hashem, the greatness of creation, the sun, the moon, the stars, the birds, the fish in the sea. Everything that Hashem created is nothing short of majestic and amazing and miraculous. And then we reflect upon our role, our place in that world. And our place is truly a contradiction. That on the one hand, we are nothing. We are the dust of the earth. From the dust we came, into the dust we are going to return. We're puny, we're pathetic. Hashem created us, and what do we do with it? We make mistakes all the time. We blow it nonstop. Our Yetzirah prevents us from fulfilling our mission and our mandate and our purpose in this world. And on the other hand, literally in the next pasuk, we look at Hashem and we say, Hashem, you created us so great. You created us with a neshama, with a chelek eloka mimal, with the capacity to learn Torah and perform mitzvahs and connect to you. That's the contradiction. That's the dichotomy which is inherent within mankind. Now this again, pasuk, as I reflected upon just a few minutes ago, I'm sorry, this parak of Tehillim I said, is very famous. One of the reasons why it's famous is because it appears in the Gemara in Shabbos. Those learning Daf Yomi will recognize it because we read it very recently. In the pasuk in Shabbos, I'm sorry, the Gemara in Shabbos tells us that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to receive the Torah, the angels were less than happy. And Hashem says to the angels, why are you so unhappy? The angels say, Ma yilud ish beinenu. What is this finite, pathetic mankind doing amongst us, right, that was born of flesh and blood, is going to come from the earth and return to the earth? What is it doing here? So Hashem says, oh, he's here to return the Torah. The angels say, you've hidden away this Torah for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of generations, and you're going to waste it on mankind? And then it quotes, the angels quote our pasuk, Ma'anosh ki tizkarenu. Mankind is so pathetic. We have a Yetzirah, we're so imperfect. You're going to waste your Torah on mankind? Ma'adir shimcha b'chol aretz. Adonai Adonenu, right? The angels say, Hashem, you are so great. And you're going to give your great Torah to such a pathetic person? So what does Moshe Rabbeinu respond? Moshe Rabbeinu says, yeah, that's exactly what Hashem is going to do. Because the Torah wasn't written for you angels, the Torah was written for us. It was written to tell us how to conduct our lives, how to live ethically and morally, how to make the world a better place. That's exactly what the Torah was. And so when the angels hear that, they say checkmate, and they all hug and kiss, and Hashem gives Moshe Rabbeinu the Torah. But this is exactly, that conversation in the Gemara in Shabbos is exactly the tension about mankind. Moshe Rabbeinu comes up and the angels say, what is he doing here? He doesn't have a place with our Torah. And when they're convinced, they realize that while we might not be perfect, we have enormous potential. The Torah was given to us to help elevate us and to perfect us. And it's based on that that I want to share a comment by Rav Hirsch. Okay? Rav Hirsch on Pasuk Gimel says something amazing. Pasuk Gimel, right? That was the one about the children. In the mouths of the children, we see the greatness of Hashem. Leman tzorerecha. For your tzorerecha. Most 99.9% of the Mefarshim understand tzorerecha as your enemies, except for Rav Hirsch. So often Rav Hirsch views these in counterintuitive fashion. Rav Hirsch says, what is the word tzorerecha come from? Mitzrayim, right? Mina meitzar comes from the word to confine, to limit, right? Mina meitzar karasika. From my limited purview, Hashem, I call out to you. In other words, we say, Hashem, I don't have the full understanding, but from my limited perspective, I cry out for you. Mitzrayim. Why does the word Mitzrayim contain the word meitzar, tsar? Because Paro tried to limit our understanding of Hashem. Paro tried to limit our appreciation of Hashem in this world. In Mitzrayim, we were meitzar. we were limited in our understanding of Hashem. That's what Paro wanted. And when we were redeemed, Ra'asa Shivcha Alayam, we suddenly became aware of certain things that we couldn't be aware of when we were in Mitzrayim. And so says Rav Hirsch, Sorer comes from the word to confine or to limit in space. Says Rav Hirsch the following words. These men, namely our enemies, would banish Hashem from the thoughts of mortals. No, they want to confine Hashem. They would leave no room for God's guiding presence in actual everyday living, but would confine the worship of Hashem to certain places, times, and occasions, to temples, churches, synagogues, festivals, and special ceremonies of life. Whoa. This is classic Rav Hirsch. If you've ever read his writings, you know this is vintage Rav Hirsch. But Rav Hirsch says, what do the enemies want us to do? This will blow your mind away, I promise you. What do our enemies try to do? They try to confine Hashem. And what are they confining Hashem to? Certain places, in certain times. In other words, they're not saying God doesn't exist. God exists. But he only exists in a shul. If you're outside of a shul, forget God. God exists, but he exists on Shabbos and Yontif. Tuesday, when you go to work, check God at the door. Now you go into your business life, right? The enemies essentially want to argue that there's a bifurcation in our lives. There's the Philip Moskowitz that has a, right? There's Philip Moskowitz when he has a relationship with Hashem. And then there's a Philip Moskowitz where he checks Hashem at the door. And now I go off into the marketplace. I go off into my workplace. And I chuck the yarmulke, so to speak. And now all I do is I go about my business. I'm ruthless and tenacious in earning the extra dollar. Right? That's what our enemies want to do. They're going to concede God to us, but only to certain places. Right? God doesn't exist in my home. He only exists in shul. God doesn't exist when I go to Publix. He only exists when I'm in a base medrash. God doesn't exist when I'm on vacation. He only exists on Shabbos and Yontif. That's what the enemies, and the enemy could be actual enemy, it could be the Yetzer Hara right now, but that's what they try to convince us. They try to confine God to certain areas and certain times and certain places. And we, of course, know that nothing could be further from the truth. I want to read for you right now one of the most magnificent comments of Rabbi Soloveitchik. This comes from, and we probably read it before, but this comes from, here we go, this comes from his halachic man. Let me zoom in a little bit for those who are like me and getting older in age. Got a big birthday coming up. When's my birthday? Next week? 2 weeks? I've got a big birthday, so my eyes are starting to get a little worse. It's okay. Baruch Hashem, it comes with age. Okay? So here says Rabbi Soloveitchik, and again, his words are a little bit complicated, but this will be one of the most magnificent things you've seen in a very long time. Says the Rav the following in his halachic man. There we go. Now I can read. The dualism so prevalent in other religions, which distinguishes between man who stands before the Lord in an atmosphere suffused with heavenly solemnity, nice way of saying Kedusha, and the man driving a hard bargain with his fellow in the marketplace, is totally foreign to the halacha. In other words, there is no dualism. There are no two Philip Moskowitz. There's no Philip Moskowitz in the marketplace and Philip Moskowitz in shul. Those don't exist. It's one and the same. He says here the following, and again, I'm happy to send this to anyone. Even when the halachic man enters the synagogue or the base medrash, he does not leave this worldly life behind. His prayer is replete with requests regarding bodily needs, healing, prosperity, political freedom, a good and peaceful life, and such. Right? In other words, when we come into shul, we don't check our lives at the door. Quite the opposite. We bring it in with us. It informs our life when we come into shul. The strange, disturbing dualism that blossoms forth in other religions is grounded in the fragmentation of life into many different sectors. Right? Other religions fragment life, he says. The universal homo religiosus, in other words, secular or non-religious person, not infrequently sets up markers and draw sweeping demarcation lines till here is the divine heavenly transcendental realm, and from this point on is the earthly realm. In other words, there's the physical me and the spiritual me, but those are bifurcated. Homer religiosus, praying in a house of worship, prostrate in the cold stone floor, repeating over and over again the old litany, is not the moment at this worldly man, a possessor of riches and chattels, estates and factories, who drives his impoverished workers ruthlessly, whose hands are often stained with the blood of the outcast and the ill-gotten gain wrung from the hands of the unfortunate. For him, the world of prayer and the world of reality have nothing to do with each other. In other words, there's God, and then there's my real life, but they have nothing to do with each other. He enters his sanctuary humble and contrite in a mood of submission and humility. In this religious atmosphere, filled with the thick clouds of incense and the echoes of the hymns of the angels, he divests himself of arrogance, right? In other words, he's pure and he's holy. But that same person, right? That same man, when he goes into the marketplace, he becomes a different person. The man in the sanctuary and the man in the marketplace are two separate and distinct personalities who have absolutely nothing in common with one another. Right? There's the Philip Moskowitz in the business world and the Philip Moskowitz in the base medrash. Right? And those are two separate people. They're not one and the same. He goes on to say, the halacha, however, rejects such a personality split, such a spiritual schizophrenia. It does not differentiate between the man who stands in a shul, engaged in ritual activities, in the mortal who must wage the arduous battle of life. The halacha declares that man stands before God not only in shul, but also in the public domain, in his house, while on a journey, while lying down, and while rising up. Those are the words of Hirsch. Those are the words of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Says of Hirsch, that's exactly what we're talking about here. Leman sorerecha. Our enemies want to limit Hashem. They want to say God only exists in the shul. God only exists in the base medrash, but not check him at the door. He's not going to come with you to work. And he's not going to come with you to Publix. And he's not going to come with you to the gym. And so while in shul, you might live a holy spiritual life. When you go to the gym, you can look at whatever you want. And when you're on your computer, you can do whatever you want. No, says the Rav. Halacha doesn't differentiate between that. We are one and the same. And then he drops the hammer. He drops the hammer. To me, every shir I say there's like a money back guaranteed moment. There's the price of admission. It's this quote right here. Here we go. The halacha is not hermetically enclosed within the confines of cult sanctuaries. Right? Think about the words of reverse. God is not limited to shul, but penetrates into every nook and cranny of life. And why I love this idea, I love it in general, but certainly as we still remain quasi-quarantined, right? Don't think just because you can't come to shul that you don't have a relationship with Hashem. Don't think just because you don't come to shul that you can't daven and learn and achieve high levels of kedusha. Because says the Rav, the marketplace, the street, the factory, the house, the meeting place, the banquet hall, all constitute the backdrop for the religious life. What beautiful words, right? When you and I go to the market, that's religion, right? If we conduct ourselves with honesty and integrity, if we say hello and please and thank you and smile and create a Kiddush Hashem, that is the backdrop to a religious life, right? When I'm at work and I conduct myself with dignity and a reflection of my Jewish values, so that's a backdrop to religious life. There's not a bifurcation of Philip Moskowitz. I'm one and the same. I'm fulfilling my mission and my mandate and my purpose in life no matter where I am. The synagogue does not occupy a central place in Judaism. That's where I said the Rav drops the hammer, right? The shul does not occupy a central place in Judaism. What crazy words. By the way, the Ravs can say that, I can't say that, right? What does he mean? When liberal Judaism expelled the Shechina from the broad arena of Jewish life, it set aside a special place for it in the temple, right? In other words, you had to be Jewish, you put on your kippah when you came into shul, but the second you left shul, you chucked it, right? You had to be religious when you came into shul, but the second you left it, you could do whatever you wanted. God didn't travel with you outside. As a result, to the liberal Jewish outlook, the temple stands at the heart of religion, right? Shul is the epicenter. right? I go to shul for my bar mitzvah, for my son's bar mitzvah, and then once my son becomes bar mitzvah, I'm out, right? The shul is the central epicenter of my religion. The halacha, the Judaism that is faithful to itself, however, which brings the divine presence into the midst of empirical reality, does not center around the shul or the base medrash. These are minor sanctuaries. The true sanctuary is the sphere of our daily mundane activities, for it is there that the realization of halacha takes place. By the way, anyone who wants to see more about this, I didn't even realize it when I wrote it, but if you read my blog this week, my article for the weekly, this is very similar to what I wrote about. But listen to those last words. The true sanctuary, in other words, our true opportunity to connect to Hashem, is the sphere of our daily mundane activities. It's everyday living, right? It's there through halacha, through conducting ourselves with honesty and integrity and dignity. That's where we ultimately find Hashem. That's where we're able to bring Hashem into this world and to create that Kiddush Hashem that all of us strive to create. So come back now to the words of Rav Hirsch. Leman Sorecha, that the enemies tried to confine. They're Sorer, Tsar. They confine Hashem. We'll give you Hashem in Shul. We'll allow Hashem to go into a Beis Medrash at a bar mitzvah. But when you go to the market, when you go to Publix, when you go to the gym, when you're at your computer late at night, right, when you're getting together with your friends, when you're going to the beach, you can check. God doesn't come with you there anyways. So what you do there and how you conduct yourselves there, that doesn't really matter anyways. Says the Rav, no, you're missing the whole point about Judaism. Judaism was never a shul-centered religion, right? Think about those words. Judaism was never a shul-centered religion, right? Rather, we fundamentally believe that God is found in everyday living, right? When I get up and I make a bracha, I find God. When I sit down to learn a little bit of Torah, I find God. When I say please and thank you, I find God, right? When I don't do borer on Shabbos, I find God, right? Hashem is there in every action that you and I do. And so don't wait until you go to shul, or don't wait until you're in a Beit Midrash, or don't wait until a ne'ilah to connect to Hashem. But opportunities for Hashem and godliness are all around us, right? I would argue, and again, this is for a different time, not when we're being recorded, but I would argue that actually our overemphasis on shul life has done a massive disservice to modern day Judaism. Because when you make shul life the centrality of Judaism, so that's where there becomes a bifurcation in terms of men and women, what can be done, what can't be done. That was never the case, and the Rav says that explicitly, right? The epicenter of Judaism was our homes. The epicenter of Judaism was everyday living, the way I conduct my life, right? It was never about shul. Shul was one mechanism to create and to connect to Hashem, but it wasn't the mechanism. We have made it the mechanism. And part of Rav Hirsch's idea, and part of Rabbi Soloveitchik's idea, is that we're simply feeding the narrative of Leman Sorecha Lahashpis Oyevu Mitnakeim. If we want to destroy those enemies, if we want to not restrain Hashem, but unleash Hashem in this world. So it starts by that recognition that Hashem isn't limited to a time or a place. Right? It could be a Thursday morning and I can connect to Hashem just as I can on Shabbos. Now obviously we believe certain times have more Kedusha than other times, 100%. Right? But the ability to connect to Hashem has never been constrained to a time and a place. I think that is a profound lesson for our generation. But let's summarize now and think about what we are going to go home with. Right? We saw a beautiful idea by Rav Hirsch, the Rav, that was honestly a little bit tangential, but it was on my mind. I think it's such a beautiful idea, certainly as we're confined to our homes, to not view that as a bidyeved, but really as an opportunity for a lecharchila, to once again reinforce the notion that God is found in our homes just as he's found in our shuls. But what's this parak really about? This parak is about a reflection upon God's greatness. It's a reflection upon how beautiful and majestic and amazing the world is. And inherent in that is a contradiction of mankind. That on the one hand, because God is so great, he's infinite and his world is so great, you and I are puny and nothing and pathetic. On the other hand, at that very same moment, what do we read? V'tichasrehu me'at me'elohim. God made us in the image of the divine. He created us with a neshama. He created us with a chelek eloka mimal, the opportunity and the obligation to be able to connect with him. So I personally found this Parakatilam enormously relatable and enormously profound, certainly for any time period we're living in, but certainly this one. Because if there's any moment in my life where I became intimately aware of both my capacity for greatness but also my limitations, it was this time period of coronavirus. That in the year 2020, when scientific knowledge and know-how has come so far, and as mankind has conquered things that we 50, 60, 100, 200, 300 years ago never would have thought would be imaginable, right? And all of a sudden they're ubiquitous in our lives. Mankind has come so far, and yet, at the moment that we've come so far, we've also become intimately aware, profoundly aware, sadly aware of just how limited mankind, of just how quickly mankind could be brought to our knees at the snap of the fingers. And it's that tension, it's that eternal tension that pulls us in both directions, which I am feeling nowadays. It's that, on the one hand, that humility of realizing that the greatest doctors in the world have no clue what they're talking about. World Health Organization coming out and telling us things that we've been doing all wrong, right? They don't, right? As my wife says, right, this is unprecedented in medical history, that we're literally making it up as we go along without years and years of longitudinal research studies, right? We don't have that luxury now. We have to figure it out as we go along, right? The humility that has brought to me is profound. The awareness of just how limited we are. And on the other hand, to be reminded, v'techasreyu me'at me'elohim, that at that moment of humility, we also were reminded that we have that neshama, that Hashem expects big things from us, that even in moments of tragedy and in moments of challenge and adversity, God expects us to be like that olive press and that wine press, to emerge stronger and more refined and more elevated. That tension that each one of us feels is the tension of this Parakat Tehillim. I hope it spoke to you. I hope you found it relatable. And again, as I say each and every week, I hope everyone stays safe, stays healthy, and stays besimcha, keeping that beautiful smile on your face. Have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos.